Hello, comrades, and welcome back to Season 5, Episode 2 of Spectre. I'm delighted today to be joined by Sophie Johnson from Stop the War Scotland. Sophie, it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks, Nathan. Delighted to be here.
Perfect. So I guess just to kind of kick us off, a wee introduction from yourself, you know, who you are, your affiliations and everything else in between.
Yeah, so I am Sophie Johnson, as you said. I have been Secretary of Stop the War Scotland for the last 2.5 years. So this is my second term. And for those that maybe don't know what Stop the War Coalition is or have only heard of us in passing, we were founded in 2001 in aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, and were founded to bring a mass coalition together in opposition to the war on terror, and in particular, the British involvement in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And since then, we have campaigned tirelessly against British militarism ever since, right through from Iraq and Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, right to more recently, we have been involved in campaigning for peace in Ukraine and have been at the heart of the Palestine solidarity movement here.
Oh, great stuff, Sophie. Cheers for that. And yeah, you've kind of touched on, you know, what Stop the War kind of does and everything that's in involvement. You know, you're just looking to see if you can talk about, you know, some of the work you guys are doing now, especially up here in Scotland.
Yeah, I don't need to kind of say how important it is to have a strong anti-war movement across the UK at this current moment in time. We are seeing a period of extreme volatility emerge in the world system. And obviously, a lot of our work over the last few years in Scotland and across the UK has been centred around the horrors that have been taking place in Gaza and the role of our governments in that genocide. But we've also been we also understand that there is a bigger context here, and that we are seeing mass militarisation taking place across Europe, precipitated in part by the onset of the war in Ukraine, but also by the United States demanding more and more military spending, which looks set to increase again. I read a report in the BBC this morning that suggests that the government is planning to more rapidly increase the defence budget at a cost of billions more pounds in the coming years. So we have been campaigning, like our counterparts across the UK, against such measures, and in Scotland we have a particular role as well, because Scotland is increasingly emerging as an extremely exposed part of the world system. We have seen in recent weeks the use of civilian infrastructure being used by the United States to enforce the blockade on Venezuela. We have seen a new focus on the position of nuclear weapons and the fact that Scotland is home to nuclear weapons, which depends on the United States. So we have a role in Scotland in raising the particular Scottish dimensions of this increasingly dangerous period we've been living in. And so we've been organising a range of demonstrations, political lobbies, around a range of issues, including against the horrific attack on President Maduro and Scotland's role within that. And coming up, we are organising a national demonstration on the 11th of April around Break with Trump. We want to bring all elements of the movement from Gaza to those involved in solidarity with Cuba, with Venezuela, from those that are looking across the water at the United States and thinking that we want nothing to do with this. And we are building a mass demonstration that is calling for an end to the relationship with the United States, for nuclear weapons, for Trident to be taken away from Scotland. We want the government to scrap Trident. And we're also continuing to put Gaza at the center of that. I mean, it's kind of an interesting situation here. And I think this again goes to the heart of why we need a strong anti-war movement in this period. In some ways, we have made huge headway in recent years over carving out a political space in which you can oppose such things as what's been happening in Gaza and the government's role in that. In Scotland, we have had a Palestine solidarity movement which has successfully pushed the Scottish government to stop putting money into weaponry that has been used by Israel, for example. Although we can be talk about how effective that has been in the long term, but at least rhetorically we have won that position. But some things like nuclear weapons, which has always been central to the SNP, the governing party's politics, have completely dropped off the agenda. We've got an election coming up, and if the SNP really wanted to, they could make nuclear weapons and Trident central to that. And I think they would find it to be a very, very popular argument. Most people in this country are really, really concerned about the relationship of the United States. They are really, really concerned about the way that the United States is attacking and threatening the sovereignty of a whole range of countries. And that just does not have the representation you would expect in the official political system, not just in the UK government, but also in the Scottish government. So we have a really, really important role in Scotland, I think.
Yeah, no, absolutely superb, Sophie. I think that kind of breaks everything down there, and more importantly, touches on the kind of importance of the anti-war movement, especially in Scotland. I guess looking into it, you don't realise the kind of role Scotland plays in terms of facilitating US imperialism. We're practically a lily pad just before Europe. It's what Britain's kind of devolved into just after the Second World War, is just being a landing strip for, US military planes, personnel, and everything else in between. And after the recent, illegal seizure of that Russian oil tanker and Scottish waters, wasn't enough to send alarm bells ringing for people in terms of what Scotland's priorities are on the international stage, then it sure certainly should know.
Bad. Yeah, no, I need to make the point that we only really need to look at a map to see Scotland's geographical position in this new kind of military build-up that we are seeing in the North Atlantic. Just a few days ago, Starmer announced that there will be a new fleet heading northwards into the high north. We are seeing, and as we saw with the attack on the Russian-flagged tankard, we are seeing the United States more and more belligerent and forceful as it consolidates its power in the Western Hemisphere. We have seen its behaviour over Greenland. And Scotland, as Britain is essentially a vassal state to the United Kingdom, Scotland is a central kind of launch pad within that vassal state. And we need to be kind of at the forefront of making that widely known and talking here about what that means for us. I mean, in many ways, it means that we are increasingly on the front line in this new period of instability.
Yeah, no, bang on, absolutely. And looking at, I guess, in the political spectrum, with the SNP and whatnot, it's always been a kind of, they've always remained, committed to imperialism in one way or another. whether it's been through NATO, as they've continued to maintain that, you know, in a post-independent Scotland, it'll still be shackled, if you like, to NATO, and thus the whims of, you know, the US, even though, you know, you've got Trump saying he's not caring too much. We all know that America runs the show for NATO. It foots the bill on almost everything. So, you know, there's no getting away from the international policy of the United States and what that means actually domestically for us. So I thought you covered that really, really well, Sophie. And I guess it kind of, we've talked about, you know, the work you guys are doing on the international side of things as well, but more importantly, you know, the welfare not warfare campaign, your national demonstrations, these have all kind of very well coherently tied in what we've just talked about, how the impact of, you know, Britain's international policy is having a detrimental effect to those here at home. You know, that boomerang of imperialism really hitting people. It was just to see if you can give us a kind of breakdown of this campaign and you know, some of the work yous are doing behind that.
Yes, so the Welfare Not Warfare campaign, which we launched last year, and which we see as a long-term campaign, is really aimed at making that connection explicit between the economic and the international, the domestic economic and the international political direction of things. I mean, and I think that you can see this as a very bargain making, especially when you look at the response of some of the trade union leadership over these questions in the last few years. We have a situation now where the government and the leadership of some trade unions, not all trade unions, but some trade unions, has been telling us that a military economy, an economy that is focused excessively on defence and on the military industry is going to be a good economy for workers. And I think that is absolute. I think that is absolutely false. We are talking about a situation where billions and billions more pounds are being funneled into the defence budget. Most of that money will not stay here. It will just go into the hands of your multinational corporations, which never spend any of the profits here, by the way. But we are also living through a period where wages have been stagnant for more than 10 years in most sectors, where our public services are crumbling on the brink of collapse in many places. Councils are heading into bankruptcy. And then on top of that, you have government who's committed to piling resources, the remaining resources that exist into this defence industry. And so the idea that that's going to be a win for the working class is just absolutely nonsense. And even as some have suggested, that might mean that there are a few more jobs in the defence sector, although I think that's also grossly exaggerated. I don't think we will see huge amount of jobs, skilled jobs opening up either, because of the kind of globalized nature of these supply chains that are fairly labor light domestically. But we are talking about the future of working class living standards essentially. And so trade unions and ordinary workers organized need to be at the forefront of that. So the Welfare Not Warfare campaign is working in trade unions, trying to bring together trade unionists to make these arguments at the rank and file level as well as at the national level. It's also where we're rolling out a number of public meetings in areas which are outside of the kind of traditional city centres where we really want to get to working class communities and you know, make some of these arguments and bring people into the anti-war movement in that way. And I think again these are, and we found so far that these are very popular arguments. I mean, most people understand that pouring more and more money into defense is not in the interest of ordinary people, and more broadly, most people do not want to be heading into a situation where we are at the forefront of a drive to war and all that that entails. So the welfare will not warfare campaign is really about bringing these things together and trying to bring as many people into the anti-war movement as possible and getting that information out there.
Yeah, no, that's great, Sophie. Cheers for that kind of breakdown, and absolutely echo what you're saying about the kind of public meetings that are taking place, outside from kind of Glasgow or Edinburgh, etc. Because these are some of the small towns and small cities that have been decimated as a result of the post-Thatcher years, the shutting down of industry, deindustrialisation, and they've been abandoned essentially from the labor movement, because we lost our workplaces. So where were the trade unions meant to kind of organize there? And I think we're quite in a lucky position maybe here in Scotland with the role of the trades councils and how they're able to kind of do so much in the communities, but bring that back into the union movement as well through the STUC, and actually having a seat at the Congress, being able to send delegates and put motions in, etc. It's something that we don't actually have in England, and it's probably one of the reasons the TUC has lost its kind of radical character, and especially these recent years. So, no, I think those public meetings are really great in terms of bringing the kind of question to these communities. Take like Western Bartonshire, for example. Obviously, sitting with Trident in Fast Lane. Just in the kind of backdrop near Helensburgh and everything. So, that is a question that gets asked, especially when you've got, like you said, so many young workers kind of feeling that they have to tie themselves to a military economic model, essentially, is what's trying to be fostered and what we're seeing in the unions trying to consolidate with as well. But it's detrimental, not just to how actually build up a town and what it needs, but the lasting effects on that. The big question now, obviously, has been for the last couple of years, has been that on immigration and the impact that war has on that. I think it was the most kind of what they were describing as the recent wave of immigration came from Syria, and trying to explain to people. Explain to those who are leaning towards probably the likes of reform and other reactionary forces, are saying, well, yeah, it's the immigrants coming over here and stuff like that. What's actually happening and why immigrants are coming to this country, especially from a place like Syria, is a direct result of what Britain's been doing over the course of decades of constant destabilization and installing its own puppet leaders in place. The new president of Syria was formerly on the US Most Wanted list for a bounty of $10 million. And now he's been putting the front page of magazines as, a beacon of democracy within Syria now. So you've got so many people from Syria who are fleeing religious persecution, and, just the barbarity of this new regime. And, those carrying out that coup would have been using British and American-made weapons, and thus, they see that symbol and follow that home to its source. Britain's, we're constantly told that there's no magic money tree for what ordinary people are needing. Rachel Reeves, she's really good at splitting that line out whenever she gets the chance. But Britain is a very rich nation. It's just the money's in somebody else's pockets and not our own. So, it's recognized the world over, and that's why, people come back. The former colonies of Britain's empire are coming home to see, where the fruits are, being kept, and it's been being kept in, private equity and everything else in between. And the heart of London, or, for those dodging tax, they're basing themselves out in Monaco or elsewhere to avoid, paying their share to even begin with. So, no, I think that having those meetings in these smaller areas has been really good. We've seen a big impact to that in Western Bartonshire, and drawing people to the question of welfare, not warfare, and realizing, that It's an untenable position to keep this going. And you know, whilst we're starting to kind of win that battle of ideas just in our community, I think the next place will be, you know, the unions as well, like you said, and we'll probably come on to talk about that in just a wee minute, the kind of importance of the trade unions in the fight for peace. Sometimes, you know, the fight is in the trade union itself, being a GMB member. It's sleepless nights trying to deal with that and get that argument through. But just want to see, you know, from your perspective, you know, how you see the importance of the unions being involved with Stop the War and, you know, in the broader sense of that kind of fight for peace.
Yeah, so I mean, Stop the War Coalition is a coalition by name and by nature, and trade unions have always been central to that, and to helping bring their members into this wider fight, and have always been completely crucial. I think that the role of trade unions, it is about making again that kind of explicit connection between the international and economic. And the truth is that the trade unions and the organized working class, the ones that have been the greatest defense of working class living standards over the last 15, 20 years and beyond, in very difficult circumstances. So it needs to so the unions need to essentially extend that fight to the political arena in ways that has often been reluctant to in recent years. Saying that, there has been some serious wins over the last few years, often from the rank and file within them. We saw that members of Unite managed to win the union to a position in which Unite was forced to recognise that it would protect union members that refused to handle weaponry headed for Israel. So that was extremely important. The TUC in England obviously has a recent tradition of being more conservative than the Scottish Trade Union Congress, but a huge campaign was launched around the Wages Not Weapons motion, which was successfully passed recently, and I think that has made a big impact and has armed trade unionists with a precedent to continue these fights into their workplaces. So that has been fantastic. We've also seen in the last few years some extraordinary initiatives taken by trade unionists across Europe against this militarization, against making that connection between workers' rights and the drive to war. We saw the general strike take place in Genoa and spread out across the Mediterranean in recent years, in recent months, which was incredible. And we saw last year the peace conference in Paris, which brought together 4,000 workers, mainly from trade union, mainly trade unionists, into a huge kind of conference and rally, and which allowed members from different unions to learn from each other and build those international links. And that's something that is going to be repeated in London this June, at the London Peace Conference. So we are hoping thousands of trade unionists again will be headed to this conference. I'm hoping that we're campaigning for a sizable Scottish delegation to get there as well. Often we're underrepresented when it comes to London events, so I would like to see that happen. But yeah, I would I mean I think we all know that basically the anti-war movement is only as strong as the workers that are involved in it. And so we need to use things like the London Peace Conference to really build that internationalism again within our unions to make sure that the anti-war movement is as strong as possible as it possibly can be. So I would urge anyone who hasn't heard of this peace conference that's taking place in London to look at the Stop the War website and download the model motion and try and get that passed through your trade union branch or through your trades council. I've got this motion coming up in my Unison branch next week, so I'm hoping that will pass. But we've seen extraordinary spread of branches from all across the UK and all across Europe, in fact, passing these motions. And we're hoping to see thousands of people down in London this summer for it.
Oh, great stuff, Sophie. Cheers for that. And yeah, no, it's good to hear, I guess, kind of some of the wins and some of the big things kind of coming up, or even some of the smaller things that, you know, kind of pave the way. It can be a kind of doom and gloom environment sometimes, I guess, talking about facing up to the global war machine of, you know, the US and Britain. So, you know, taking those small wins and those small actions is food for thought, and, you know, food to keep moving forward is definitely great. And it's funny you should touch on the kind of international kind of scenes in like Greece and Italy. It was actually something that I'd wrote about in the Morning Star in regards to how we see this kind of disparity between the radical action taken by those in Italy and Greece compared to here back home in our own trade union movement. I think obviously the kind of draconian trade union laws that are in place have had an impact in terms of how the unions can organize on that. But more importantly, it brings us back to the what we've kind of touched on with some of the unions, you know, being quite complacent and, you know, more so complicit in building Britain's war machine. So any kind of action to kind of destabilize that or certainly actually do something that would have an impact to the supply chain and the profits of these, you know, warmongers and private profiteers. We just don't see it. And I think speaking as, you know, somebody in the GMB, one of the unions that's always in the kind of spotlight for all the wrong reasons, especially on, you know, the question of war and militarism, is that, you know, the unions are kind of fostering that's really damaging environment of, you know, secrecy and fear within the unions. You know, it doesn't feel that there's room for any genuine grassroots opposition to any question of, you know, changing Britain's economic strategy away from warfare and into welfare. And that's been echoed by, you know, various general secretaries and other figures within the union. So, you know, it makes it a fearful atmosphere to even bring up these questions. And it's perhaps something that's been touched on here in Scotland to the fact that you've got workers who are in the kind of defence industry or involved in arms in some way or another, where whether it be working at Thales or BAE Systems, etc. And they're in either the GMB Union or Unite, and they've said to Palestine campaigners that they don't feel comfortable, you know, bringing these conversations up in their union about, you know, getting motions put forward or bringing things to the branches. It's just not a safe environment for them to do it. You know, the risk of being kind of ostracized and kind of left out from the democratic, you know, procedures is, you know, probably even more damaging, knowing that you're in there and just can't get involved properly, almost being blacklisted in your own union. So, you know, when you get characters for a more generous word in these unions who, you know, go on about how well, members aren't saying this, or members in these industries are, you know, they're not coming to us and saying this. It's because they can't. They genuinely feel that they can't have these conversations and, you know, begin to even lay the foundations to pull off actions such as dock workers in Greece or those in Italy as well. So, you know, I think it's time for a lot of, you know, perhaps full-time officials and everything to wake up and smell the coffee in regards to why their members aren't coming to them, or coming to, you know, their reps and secretaries and conveners and whatnot, across these industries because it's just no stable environment for them to actually put their head above the trenches, where risk of getting shot down. And obviously you mentioned there about the kind of TUC and getting some of these motions through in regards to even just recognizing that the war economy is a bad idea. And that takes a lot of graft, really trying to like get it to two branches at the TUC. Then these union branches, like I said, they don't have the, I guess, the luck of having the trades councils there who put more radical motions forward. But on the flip side of that, you've got the unions who work hard to ensure the opposite. It reminded me of when Gary Smith's article in Labour List, when it was basically demanding and berating those who'd vote against what he called solidarity with Ukraine. And it's this position that's existed within the trade union movement, which has, but I feel, began to kind of shift. There is more question around the topic of Russia and Ukraine in terms of constant so-called military aid in a region, which just seems to be a testing ground for these companies to examine their prototypes and build it for future wars, whether that's going to be something in the Middle East, between Palestine and Israel, or even further in that front against Iran. But it's this berating nature that comes even at the very top of these unions to hamper those who raise genuine questions about continued so-called military aid into one of the most reactionary governments in Eastern Europe, who the 2014 Euromaidan coup had murdered and set fire to fellow trade unionists. So to be able to stand at a platform and try downplay the humanitarian crimes that have existed in this post-2014 government, and now with the Zelensky regime, it's a brass neck, to the trade union movement and what it stands for, because we can't just, like you said, we can't just keep on this question of a war economy and just building on that, whether it's new contracts for NATO vessels, or anything else in between. It's an untenable position, and it will be the workers even involved, in one way or another, whether it's highly skilled workers involved in the making and manufacturing, or those who gain employment as a result of the kind of circumference of that. If wider warfare does go ahead, with the state of Britain's military, it will be the question of conscription will come to the forefront. It's already kind of been teased, hasn't it? Where so-called former generals or former NATO generals, I don't believe there is such a thing really as former general. You're in that kind of atmosphere one way or another. You're always involved in it, and teeing up this idea of conscription is a real reality for us here in Britain. And it'll be those same union members who'll face the kind of consequences of those in their own movement who've been hampering on and egging on war for so long. But like I said, it's good to hear that there are those smaller wins happening even within the union movement, and the importance that just even lay members can do and actually making a difference in the union. So that was great to hear.
No, I think, I mean, Stop the War Coalition has position over Ukraine and over a whole number of other questions has been a very simple one, and it has put us actually at very much at the kind of cutting edge of political debate, and we were berated for this position 4 years ago at the beginning of Russia's invasion in Ukraine. And that is very simply, whatever you think of the situation in Ukraine, whatever you think about the government or the nature of the attack on Ukraine. British weapons and British bombs are never going to help the situation. They cannot be repurposed for moral reasons, as the British government has tried to place. And a militarization, which we foresaw would be taking place, a push towards greater defence spending, is never going to be in the interest of the working class here, nor was it going to be in the interest of those Ukrainians and Russians that it would be used against. And that position has unfortunately borne out. We are entering into the fourth year of a war in Europe, in which there has been long past the million mark in casualties. We're looking at trench warfare of the bloodiest nature. And unfortunately, it was something, it was a position that very much divided those on the left and those within the trade union movement more generally. But I think you're right. I think there has been a shift, and I think it has come alongside partly the horrors of what's been happening, partly the length of time in which it has been going on, in which our government has sought to prolong the war for its own political reasons. But partly because of the Palestine solidarity movement, and possibly in an indirect way, in which more and more people very much understand that the government in this country does not act in the interests of let alone people here. It does not act in the interests of people abroad, and I think it's very, very simple, and it's made it a much easier territory for us to be making the argument for peace and a ceasefire in Ukraine, which we've been making from the start, in the context of the absolutely rotten and despicable nature of our government over its support for the genocide that has been taking place in Gaza. I think also you mentioned conscription, and I think this is an interesting question as well, and is a symptom of exactly the type of world we are heading into, and really kind of underlines the seriousness of the situation. I think when Rishi Sunak first floated the idea of conscription when he was on his way out of Downing Street, most people found it almost laughable, and they thought, you know, this is ridiculous. This will never happen. However, there are 9 EU states, 9 European Union states that have full conscription program for full conscription, and we have in recent months we've seen Germany and France enact schemes that are designed to if not fully conscript in the way that we would normally understand conscription, but certainly to coerce young workers into military service. So I personally don't know if we are at a stage when where the government is going to try and push through conscription in this country. I mean, it would have a very hard job of it because of the absolute unpopularity of not just the Labour government, but the political establishment writ large. So it's quite possible that they're not really in a position to try and push this through without a mass response from the population, which I hope would be the response. But what we do know is that the British government has been at the forefront of warmongering over Ukraine. It has been at the forefront of appeasing Donald Trump in the White House in the United States over its repeated aggressions over the last year and a half. And it has also been incredibly draconian on issues of civil liberties. It is not the case. It is very much the case the opposition to foreign policy has been at the very sharp edge of the kind of brutal attacks on freedom of speech, on the right to protest, the right to make a conscientious position over British foreign policy. And we've seen that with the Palestine movement completely. We've seen thousands of people being arrested for the support of Palestine action, which has luckily been has been challenged in the court, and that has been very good. But we have seen a very intense struggle over the right to oppose these things. So conscription is one of those things that you know we can see on the horizon, and we need to be prepared to make sure that we do not get to that point, and that we have a strong enough and broad enough anti-war movement.
Yeah, no, superb. 100% agree there, Sophie. That was great. And, you know, I guess that kind of brings us on to the last point, I feel like, about, you know, Scotland's place in this kind of new age of warfare. We've kind of hinted about it at the start. But, you know, after, you know, talking about everything from, you know, the work that you guys are doing, the importance of trade unions and everything else in between, you know, with the recent, I guess, further aggressions by the US. You know, what position does this put kind of Scotland in, and you know, for, you know, what many will class as a kind of smaller nation in terms of, you know, our population and whatnot, even in the question of conscription. You know, where does Scotland kind of stand in this new kind of global age of heightened warfare, if you like?
Yeah, completely exposed. We do not have a government here that is interested in standing against this drive to war and this new kind of period of conflict. That is not interested in standing up to Donald Trump or the United States in any substantial way. We've talked already about the use of civilian infrastructure. I think that is only likely to increase as the United States becomes more assertive in this region of the world. We have seen obviously Prestwick Airport used time and time again for the United States forces. We see regularly the United States carry out testing in and around Scotland. And then we also have the wider question of sovereignty that is coming into play in a very big way. We talked about the attack on the Marinera in the North Atlantic, but we also saw in the aftermath of that something quite extraordinary, which I think we're set to see more of. After that attack, the crew were held in Scottish waters for many days, and when the captain of that vessel, when his wife applied to a Scottish court, the Scottish High Court of Session, to make sure that her husband and the crew were not taken away from Scottish waters because they were feared of what the United States would do. Once the court granted that injunction, the United States just ignored it. They literally kidnapped people from Scottish territory or British territory, you might say, away into the United States. So what we are seeing there is a kind of flagrant attack on the sovereignty of institutions in Scotland, which are to a certain extent independent from British institutions. But we are seeing a kind of total disregard for anything that stands in the way of the United States here. So in Scotland, we need to be very aware of our geographical position. We need to be very aware of this kind of narrowing of democratic and kind of institutional sovereignty. And we need to think about how best we are to position ourselves in this. I think we are lucky that we have a long tradition of peace activism in this country, particularly around Fastlane and organisations like Scottish CND. And we need to be thinking strategically about how we bring these questions into the public consciousness in a massive way and bring more and more people into the fight against Scotland, essentially being used as a staging post for the United States in this new period of aggression and open conflict.
Yeah, no, bang on, Sophie. And I mean, what's to stop America, doing whatever it wants on Scottish soil, especially, it's already got so many, personnel across the rest of the island and Britain. They're stationed here in bases or, conducting drills. Which if they're more than happy to, like you said, kidnap citizens, which to stop it and just occupying parts of Scotland that it deems it needs to for, the sake of security or stability, etc. It's a joke to think that the so-called rules-based international order is something that actually truly exists, only exists against, the opponents to America's or Britain's imperialism. But when it's them carrying out their wishes and their whims, it's non-existent. It's a piece of paper that can just kind of get put in the backdraft. And aye, it's a kind of scary thought to think that that America is going unchallenged in this. Essentially, John Sweeney was questioned at Holyrood about it and gave, the kind of bog standard, very vague answer that, he's almost certainly been given from elsewhere to, try downplay everything and, keep toeing the line for the sake of the US and, maintain Britain's kind of international kind of line to America, just really sitting at their lap and letting them getting away with anything that they're wanting to achieve.
I think, I think we should be very aware at this moment. We are hearing more and more and more about the threat to our way of life, to our sovereignty, to our institutions, our political system, by Russia in particular, but also over the previous years, China. We need to swap that out. It's the United States that has proven itself to be the biggest threat, especially in the last year and a half. And we've seen how that has played out in the types of things that we've been talking about there. So we need to be building a movement that is saying that we do not want the United States acting as it pleases in Scotland. We do not want their nuclear weapons on our Clyde. We do not want their forces using our airports. We want the United States out of Scotland, essentially. And I think that needs to be at the forefront of kind of how we are organising in Scotland over the coming period.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yanks out is a message I can easily get behind. But no, I guess just to finish off, Sophie, any kind of final talking points from yourself, and where can we find Stop the War on social media and that?
Yeah, I suppose I just to thread over the quite wide ranging discussion we've had. I think one thing that is increasingly becoming more important to the types of arguments that we're making is the fight for democracy here. All of these things that we've been talking about, whether that be the increasing threats from the United States, the mass militarization, defense spending, the use of airports, and so on and so forth. None of these questions have been put to us. Scotland or Britain, normal people have had absolutely no say in any of these things, and that needs to be really central. We are seeing the narrowing of democratic horizons that have always been in the last 25 years, not exactly massive, right? There's always been limitations on what we have been allowed to protest against to some extent. But I think that really has narrowed. I mean, not even 10 years ago, the British government would, or the British Parliament would give us the courtesy of having a debate before they made interventions in Syria, for example. You cannot conceive of such a situation happening today. They act with total impunity and absolutely no oversight from anyone. You're very hard pressed to find a politician, let alone a political party that is opposed to is to oppose to defence spending, for example. So we really need to be that opposition, and we really need to be building that opposition. And that is what Stop the War Coalition is about. And it's about pulling as many people that are concerned about the way that the global system is moving, the way that working class life has been threatened, and the simple question of whether we are allowed to say anything about it, and whether we're actually allowed to mount a challenge about it. So it's about bringing all these threads together into a strong and mass movement, and that's what we've been trying to do. And I think that is going to be more and more poignant in the coming weeks and coming months, because I don't see this kind of volatility calming down in the next year or so. So I think we've got a really, really big fight on our hands. Just on where to find us. So Stop the War Scotland has a Substack, so do sign up to our email list. We also are on social media, on X and Instagram. We have fully fledged branches in Glasgow, in Edinburgh, in Fife, and activists kind of all over Scotland. Also do consider becoming a member of Stop the War Scotland or Stop the War UK nationally. Either or both would be fantastic. And do come out in force on the 11th of April in Glasgow for the Break with Trump demonstration. I think we have the potential to start building something massive here.
Yeah, no, fantastic, Sophie. And again, I just want to thank you for your time for coming on and talking about this. And you know, the work you guys have been doing has been really great. And like you said, it's going to be an uphill battle for the next, you know, year or even longer than that. If you know the US doesn't decide to go rogue and start firing off the warheads. So no, thank you again for your time. It's been great.
Thanks very much for having me on, Nathan.
Thanks again, comrades, for tuning in to another episode of Spectre. As always, be sure to leave us a like and review on whatever platform you're tuning in on. And of course, share this with your friends, comrades, co-workers, and everyone else in between. As you've heard from me and Sophie today, the fight against war and militarism isn't an easy one, but it must be a fight that's waged hard. It's a fight not only against the politicians representing the ruling class, the private profiteers in the arms and defence industry, or even the warmonger generals who appear on television screens to hype up warfare and global conflict. It's a fight that must also be waged in our own trade union movement. For far too long, we've allowed the salesmen of concessions to dominate our union movement and allow it to be lapdogged into Britain's imperialist war policies. If we seriously want to make a change to how Britain pirates across the globe, hand in hand with America and the other dogs of NATO, then we must first win the battle in our union movement, bringing welfare, not warfare, to the forefront of everything that we do. We've also got to reach out to our communities that have been isolated and abandoned following the post-Thatcher years of deindustrialisation, addressing the questions and concerns that they have surrounding Britain's international war policy and what it means for their communities. We simply can't stand idly by whilst America bullies its way across the globe in an ever-growing and heightening Cold War against China and other socialist nations. There's already been talk on the US conducting a regime change in Cuba within the close of this year. We can't stand by, and we won't stand by as America, Britain, and all the other war dogs across the world continue to destabilize nations and plunder working people into poverty. We refuse to let our home nations be the playground of America. The cry is loud and it is clear. Welfare, not warfare. Yanks out.